I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Cancer Conference Update. As today, we chat a little bit about what happened at the recent San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium done virtually in December. Today, we're going to be focusing on the management of HER2-positive breast cancer with Dr. Erica Hamilton, who also participated in the original seminar we did on HER2-positive disease with this outstanding faculty. If you'd like to check out the presentations that go along with this symposium, just download the slide set and click on this slide to get the various presentations. We're also going to show you a survey of 25 breast cancer clinical investigators. We showed some of this during the initial meeting. We'll show some more during this Meet the Professor session. And to make it a little bit more interesting, you know, San Antonio, Erica, you know, we have these sessions where they invite people to come in at lunch and just sort of present cases, where we have our own way of doing things. And we met with two general medical oncologists, Dr. Atif Hussain and Dr. Laurie Matt Amaral. And we've got four cases from them that we're going to present here today. We're going to start out with a case of Dr. Matt Amaral, and then we're going to talk about some of the San Antonio papers that were presented this year on localized disease. Then we're going to hear a case from Dr. Hussain, a patient with brain mets, and we'll talk about San Antonio papers on metastatic disease. And then we'll finish out with two really interesting other HER2 cases. We're going to try to be very clinical today. So just to take a breath before we get started, Erica, you know, Tiffany Traina showed this slide at San Antonio during one of the education sessions, sort of reflecting back on the, I don't know if the newbies to oncology know what happened in 2005, but, you know, that was the incredible session. Actually, ASCO was in Orlando at that point, or at least that year, or this incredible, quote, education session where we saw the early adjuvant trials. And I think what Tiffany was trying to get into, Erica, is like maybe this has happened again the last couple of years, and particularly at San Antonio, because we saw 2019 San Antonio, the Catherine trial that was really revolutionary, the next step in the adjuvant situation. And then, of course, last year, and you could see the pictures before we got started of our symposium there, of course, we saw the data on tucatinib and the HER-CLIMB study as well, TDXD. Maybe you can put in perspective sort of where we've come in HER2-positive disease, Erica, over this last couple of years. And is this, you know, sort of a reworking of the 2005 experience?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, 2005 is tough to compare to with trastuzumab. You know, initially we saw that data back in the 90s in the metastatic setting, but I mean, gosh, did we improve the survival and lives of women in the adjuvant space. But I agree. I mean, we've seen pertuzumab is not an old drug. I mean, that's relatively recent in the past several years. And then with tucatinib and trastuzumab deruxtecan approval within 4 months of each other, you know, the HER2 landscape really is quickly changing. And not only is it new drugs, we're getting smarter about when to use them and how to refine our use, which I think is really exciting.
So as you look back over the year, a lot of times when you see a big explosion of research, then for the next couple of years, you see more data coming out of these really landmark studies. And we're going to get into what was actually presented at San Antonio, but sort of leading up to San Antonio, and you see we're doing our year in review program where we're getting into what happened over the entire year. But from your point of view, what were some of the other things that happened this year, Erica, that you think were important in terms of HER2-positive disease? At ESMO, we saw the TRAIN study. How about that?
Yeah, I thought TRAIN was particularly interesting. You know, we still get into a lot of debate, you know, certainly for triple negative breast cancer, when you see somebody that's high risk, you want to give anthracycline. And I think traditionally, a lot of people have felt that way about HER2 disease. It's aggressive. So I kind of want to give everything there. But really, you know, with the advent of pertuzumab, and now that we're giving dual HER2 targeted therapy, you know, this question of, do we really need anthracycline? And is anthracycline a little bit riskier when we're so wedded to the fact that people really need to have good heart function and a good ejection fraction to be able to give trastuzumab, that we don't want to damage their heart with anthracycline? And so TRAIN really looked at the importance of anthracycline and really showed that when we're getting, you know, dual therapy, that anthracycline is not adding a lot. So at least in my personal practice, I favor regimens such as TCHP with the two chemos, trastuzumab and pertuzumab, but I don't add anthracycline.
So this has really been an amazing and challenging year for everybody. But one of the things I've done is I spent a lot of time talking to general medical oncologists this year on Zoom and recording cases like you're going to see today. And along the way, I get the questions that people have. And it is amazing with all the new and fascinating research. I swear, anthracycline is still one of the most common questions we get from docs in practice trying to figure this out. This is a slide that was shown by Dr. Murthy also. I really recommend the HER2 education session that they did in San Antonio. I'm going to talk more about that with Mark Pegram in the second one of these conferences. But I really like this slide where she sort of outlined some of the issues that are out there in terms of HER2 positivity. You just kind of talked a little bit about them, and we'll kind of get into that. Actually, I see a case popping into the chat room that kind of relates to a lot of these questions, Erica. You want to take a case before we get started?
Sure, let's do it.
Here we go. This is from Hassan. 32-year-old woman, newlywed, has DCIS 2 centimeters with 5-millimeter invasive component. Post-lumpectomy, sentinel lymph node negative, ER positive, HER2 positive. Which adjuvant therapy, and what about advice re-pregnancy?
None of the cases are ever easy, are they? Otherwise, they wouldn't be submitted. Yeah, you know, our data of HER2 positive breast cancers that are between that kind of 5 millimeter to a centimeter, you know, they are really not as low risk as we would think. So normally 5 millimeters is our cutoff where we think about that patient really needing a little bit of chemotherapy with HER2 directed therapy. So I'd be thinking about probably weekly Taxol Herceptin, which is, you know, 12 weeks of Taxol and you're done, finish out your Herceptin. You know, with her being newlywed, that would kind of take her through a year. I'd probably be thinking about getting pregnant after that standpoint. You know, it's tough to counsel patients that, you know, ultimately in an ideal world would be on endocrine therapy for 5 years, et cetera. But, you know, probably it's the HER2 that's a driver here. You know, if she was less than a centimeter and just ER positive, I wouldn't feel real strongly about that 5 years of endocrine therapy. And so that's probably where I would kind of settle in the middle for this patient. But certainly, I mean, that's a tough decision. And certainly you have to take into account what the patient wants to do as well.
Nicole from the chat room says, what about neratinib in this patient?
Yeah, so this is not a patient I would consider for neratinib. We normally reserve neratinib for our higher risk patients, but they're absolutely right that it's the patients with ER positive disease that we think gets the most benefit out of neratinib. But normally we're thinking about neratinib for our higher risk patients that are node positive, bigger tumors, et cetera.
Yeah, we actually had a case with 7 positive nodes we're going to present to you, but we decided to hold that. And that was the situation, ER positive, HER2 positive, where the doc was thinking about it. Well, let's get into another case. And actually, this first case with Dr. Matt Amaral sort of is not that far off, you know, gets into this issue of de-escalation of therapy. And it's really interesting, again, talking to these oncologists. I know some of the granularity of breast cancer practice. And this, I thought about what happened to this lady. I was thinking, this probably happens all the time. So this is a woman who knew she had a 1.3 centimeter node negative tumor. And she was coming to see Dr. Matt Amaral, the oncologist from the surgeon. And the surgeon said, you know, we're probably going to get you do an Oncotype on you, and you very well may not need to get chemotherapy. So the patient comes walking in expecting that was the story, that the Oncotype had been ordered and she was not going to have to get chemotherapy. And Dr. Matt Amaral had to tell her, well, sorry, but you're one of the 20% of people who is HER2 positive. So completely different story, completely different issue. In terms of chemotherapy, this lady really didn't want chemotherapy. Dr. Matt Amaral was telling me she, for example, she doesn't think she would accept the taxane because of hair loss. I said, what about T-DM1? Maybe. She actually was thinking about doing sort of a Pertain thing adjuvantly, which I never even kind of heard of, but the idea of anti-HER therapy and hormonal therapy. In any event, here's Dr. Matt Amaral. You know Erica Hamilton from Sarah Cannon?
I do, yeah.
We're presenting cases here on Monday, so that's why I thought, oh, we need some more HER2 cases.
Gotcha, okay.
Have you ever sent her a patient?
I have not. We're actually mutual friends through a women's physician group. So
really?
We're actually, yeah. So there's a group of us that are on Facebook that are a bunch of hemonc physicians that we know each other through there. So,
awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, so what's the case?
She's 42 years old. She's premenopausal. She also has a history of depression. The patient wasn't really too interested in doing chemotherapy, but that also could be a question potentially if someone feels that this case would warrant chemotherapy, I can push her harder. She kind of came to my appointment with kind of one thing in her head. And then when I said, hey, by the way, it did actually come back positive. So then she kind of got thrown for a little bit of a loop there and needed to actually kind of rethink her plan.
Any questions about the use of post-adjuvant neratinib?
I have actually used it in two patients, and they both never tolerated the medication.
Anything you'd like to hear Erica discuss about neratinib?
Yeah, I think for Erica or the investigators, my biggest question would be for the neratinib, you know, is there a way that, or someone in particular that they would say, yes, this patient should definitely have it, and here's the tips or tricks to use. You know, each investigator or clinician has some tips up their sleeve.
And another thing I hear when I talk to oncologists is really, there's like a lag when new drugs come out between when they're saying, this is really a problem, and then I'm starting to hear from the investigators, well, we're starting to figure out how to deal with this. So we can get to that in a second. But what about the basic issue here, Erica? And this sort of ties into the whole thing of, quote, de-escalation of therapy. This patient, of course, you know, obviously cases, like you say, the cases people present are not the typical cases. This way, you very, very anti-chemotherapy. How would you be thinking through this case? Would you be okay with a protein type approach? What about TDM1?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, we certainly have to work within what the patient is willing to do. You know, I have done a pertain type regimen. So for those that aren't familiar, that's really using your endocrine therapy with something like trastuzumab and pertuzumab and really switching out endocrine therapy instead of chemotherapy. I've used that for elderly patients that I really just don't think are going to tolerate chemotherapy well, but they have a HER2 cancer and we know we need to get some HER2 antibodies in. You know, for this patient, she's young. And so that really would not be my ideal regimen for her. You know, I think the bigger issue with this patient is that she came expecting one thing and that's not what she got, right? And we've all had that happen to us. And so really a lot of times I just kind of present the data on what the recurrence rate is for essentially a centimeter and a half HER2-driven tumor. Maybe give them that visit and a little bit of time at home to digest and bring them back the next week to talk about it again. Because a lot of it's just shocking and it's new information. But most women that young, you know, if they really do need a little bit of chemotherapy with HER2 therapy, ultimately are willing to do it. This is also a patient that I would probably talk to about cold capping if hair loss is her major driving factor.
That's a good point. What's your success rate with cold capping? I know it depends on the chemo.
Yeah, with taxane alone, we're pretty successful with regimens like AC followed by T, less successful, but certainly with taxanes, with HER2 regimens, we see a little bit of hair thinning, but not hair loss. And normally, you know, that's enough for patients that they can kind of escape and skate by in the real world without people really knowing that they're undergoing chemotherapy.
So you talked a little bit about your thoughts about indications for post-adjuvant neratinib. You can talk a little bit about the pearls of how to get somebody through it. I heard the same thing with alpelisib. You know, the docs in practice are just asking, what's the deal with alpelisib? I'm kind of starting to hear that you can get that under control. What about neratinib? We have the control study out there. For practical purposes, what do you do and how do your patients do?
Yeah, neratinib is a tough drug, but we are getting better at it. And you're absolutely right. It's a learning curve. So there was a study called the control study about neratinib that looked at various, antidiarrheals, such as loperamide, a drug that's actually in the GI literature called cholestipol, but then looked at something else that's actually just a dose escalation. And so you start with 3 pills, and then a week later, you go to 4, and you work your way up to the full dose of 6. And so what that actually enables is people to learn how to control the diarrhea with loperamide. And then there's also this phenomenon that as time goes on, the diarrhea gets a little less severe when the system isn't as shocked. And so people do really well with just gradually increasing that neratinib. I make sure that they have loperamide at home, that they carry it with them in their pocketbook, et cetera. But there's no doubt about it. Neratinib causes diarrhea. And so you just have to be really proactive telling your patient about that. the key is getting on board quick before it gets too severe, because it's really hard to catch up.
So a lot of questions coming in the chat room, really good ones too. They keep going back to that 32-year-old woman with a 0.5 centimeters invasive, you know, again, similar kind of situation, young woman. So one of the questions from Mayor about her is, what kind of hormonal therapy?
Yeah, so for that 32-year-old patient, I believe that she was node negative. And so our benefit with ovarian suppression and aromatase inhibitors over tamoxifen is for the patients that are node positive. So I would feel very comfortable in that 32-year-old using tamoxifen.
I like these questions. Here's another one more related to metastatic disease, but still a good question, Erica. Role of endocrine therapy concurrently with T-DM1 or T-DXd?
So two different answers. In the Catherine trial of adjuvant T-DM1, endocrine therapy was given concurrently. So was radiation. If people needed radiation, they got radiation per schedule, and then they started their endocrine therapy afterwards. So no issue giving that concurrently with T-DM1. In the metastatic setting, trastuzumab deruxtecan, we typically don't double up with endocrine therapy. We really haven't studied it that way. So I normally do not give with endocrine therapy. I give that alone, like it was kind of chemotherapy there.
Question from Praveen. Pseudo-adjuvant therapy with neratinib after treating solitary brain mets. So let's say somebody's had a brain met taken out. They don't have any other disease. What do you think about pseudoadjuvant neratinib in that situation?
I love the term pseudoadjuvant. Pseudoadjuvant for metastatic disease. I it resonates with me that this patient has had a brain met. So I am very worried about that being the area that we need to worry about the most. It's interesting, you know, we've really cured most patients that we see in the neoadjuvant and adjuvant setting with HER2 therapy. But I feel like we're seeing more brain mets because that's really a sanctuary site. So neratinib certainly is a drug that's known to have a CNS activity there. So I think this would be a reasonable scenario. If they had other systemic disease, it's something that I would be thinking about, maybe even capecitabine, trastuzumab, tucatinib there. But if there's no other disease, then I think, you know, that pseudo-adjuvant neratinib would be reasonable.
So Meyer has a really good question. You were talking about sort of giving this patient the numbers, 1.3 centimeters. I think she was let me see here. And then you have node negative, ER positive, right? Okay, 1.3 centimeters, ER positive, triple positive, node negative. So Meyer wants to know, what number would you give for her for baseline risk of recurrence? And how would that change if you give her paclitaxel trastuzumab as an example?
Yeah, so I would say it's about 30%. Which is higher than you would think there. There's a old trick that you take the tumor size. So if it's 1 to 2 centimeters, it's 20. If it's 2 to 3 centimeters, it's 30, right? That you kind of turn that into a 10. And then for things like triple negative and HER2, you add 5 to 10%. And so that's your starting calculation. Trastuzumab would decrease this by half. So that's about 15%. And then you add in your chemotherapy, that's about another 30% on top of that. Now they're not additive, it comes from the new number. So then you're getting that patient down into the less than 10% recurrence rate, which is what we want.
Actually, I'm thinking about it. We actually had a poster at San Antonio. It seems like a million years ago, but I think it was the last live San Antonio meeting where we asked 25 investigators, that we probably asked you too, like what this person said, what numbers do you give to your patients? That's all. We didn't even ask them how they treat it. Just like, what numbers do you give them? So we'll do the chat room all day, incidentally, if you have enough good questions. Elaine wants to know, cold cap therapy is a huge cost to patients, which I didn't know, and extremely time intensive, which I have heard for patients and family members. Any comments?
It absolutely is. I agree. You know, there's kind of two different ways to do the cold caps. There's the machines that you plug into the wall, and that's entirely dependent on whether your infusion center has those. We actually don't have them here. Or they're kind of more old-fashioned ways where you do the caps and patients bring in dry ice and they switch those caps intermittently. And so it is true. They are time intensive. It normally takes the patient kind of having a family member or a friend there to help them do it. So, you know, again, I tell patients generally in my clinic that if it's not hair loss, that's the number one thing that worries you, I probably wouldn't do that. I think if I was going to get chemotherapy, I wouldn't do it. But if it's the hair loss that's kind of keeping you up at night, then you can be successful if you're willing to kind of put in the time and the effort there. And I have patients that choose to do it and are really happy about doing it. And I have patients that don't and are happy too. So I think it's just another option for our patients.
So a couple more questions about the cold cap seems to have triggered people a little bit here. So Nicole saying the cold cap is not very doable in the COVID times in many cancer centers. And Anthony says, any comments on, I never heard this one, cold cap being less effective for African-American patients?
Yeah, I don't know that there's any data that I'm aware of, at least, about cold cap being less effective in African-American patients. I'm trying to think of whether there's any hair density issues or it's harder to cool the scalp. But, I've had a couple African-American patients that have done it. They have had some thinning. But I don't know that there's any great data out there. And I absolutely agree. You know, a lot of infusion rooms during COVID are not allowing kind of visitors or family members to sit in the infusion room. And that is a bit of a barrier for the cold caps.
Well, that's interesting. So I want to take a look at this graphic here. This is actually shown in San Antonio, again, in that education session, but originally Sarah Tolaney showed it at ESMO. Well, I've seen tons of these algorithms. I don't know. I'm sure they're all slightly different, but just more rather than trying to walk through the algorithm, Erica, can you talk a little bit about what they're trying to get into, which is what kind of patients are you going to quote de-escalate and think about less, and which kind of patients are you going to escalate, so to speak?
Yeah, absolutely. So the first fork in the road really here is, does this patient need neoadjuvant therapy? And so if you have a tumor size less than 2 centimeters or they're node negative, that's where you may be thinking about going to surgery. Or alternatively, if you're pretty confident in their nodal status, if you're going to give them chemotherapy, you can always do that up front. But certainly for patients that are eligible for neoadjuvant pertuzumab, the ones that are 2 centimeters or node positive, we want to be thinking about giving that TCHP up front. And the reason is, as you can see that fork over on the right of the slide, is if you have a pathologic complete response, we're probably just continuing those antibodies. But if not, then we're kind of employing our Catherine data for adjuvant T-DM1. And on the left side of our slide, those stage one patients are the taxane with trastuzumab. Those are our low risk patients that we think we can get away with doing less chemotherapy and have equally good outcomes. And so I think this is really important for our patients. A lot of our patients prefer the right size for the right patient instead of the term de-escalation. But I think we're getting smarter in HER2-positive cancer about this.
So let's cruise through a few of the papers. Actually, there weren't any orals in HER2 this year at San Antonio, but a lot of really great posters, and there was a poster discussion session. We've been talking about neratinib, but incidentally, there's a bunch of questions in the chat room about neratinib after neoadjuvant therapy. I don't know how much data there is, but I hear people talk about doing it. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, neratinib, continues to show a benefit in the patients that were hormonally driven and were high risk. The issue is when we did the neratinib studies, we didn't have adjuvant T-DM1 and we weren't giving pertuzumab. So it's really hard for me to quote to a patient that gets adjuvant T-DM1 based on the fact that they didn't have a PCR, what their benefit is going to be of adding neratinib after that. I think certainly for the patients that are hormone receptor positive and high risk, it's worth a discussion. But those patients that got T-DM1 per Catherine, their disease-free survival jumped from 77 up to 88%. So almost back to that 90% mark. So if you think you're improving things, by a couple percentage points, that really gets into the question of, is that worth it to the patient?
So again, we've been talking about neratinib. We did see some data at the San Antonio meeting. I guess this is long-term follow-up from the ExteNet study. And I guess the big thing that came out of that, I think we saw in that survey I mentioned, is how ER affects the use of neratinib. And where we saw it being considered was ER positive, lots, like you said, very high risk, positive nodes, big tumor, et cetera. I think they saw less CNS recurrence too, which I thought was interesting. We were talking about the PERTAIN study, which actually was done in metastatic disease. I thought it was a really cool study when it came out. And again, at San Antonio, we saw the long-term follow-up. Some of these patients didn't get any kind of induction. They just got the anti-HER therapy and hormonal therapy. Any thoughts about these long-term data? And is this a strategy you use in metastatic disease?
Yeah, I think it's certainly one that we're getting better at considering. So, you know, for those that aren't really familiar, PERTAIN was looking at endocrine therapy with trastuzumab and the addition of pertuzumab here. And induction therapy referred to whether they got the chemotherapy with the antibodies first before they dropped the chemotherapy out and then went on to the endocrine therapy with antibodies. So certainly did show a benefit there. I think, you know, before we've always classified HER2 positive as just grouped them all in one basket. And in reality, some of these ones that are hormonally driven are a little bit different than somebody that's ER negative and HER2 driven. So I think thinking about endocrine therapy more is likely a smart decision.
So Frankie Holmes, we got to get her on one of these things. I love talking to Frankie. She's actually in the chat room. She put the reference. Considerations for the use of scalp cooling devices in Black patients, JCO 2020.
There you go.
38. There you go. Thanks so much, Frankie. Anything you want to say about the DAPHNE trial? Kind of looking at, again, de-escalation of neoadjuvant therapy.
Yeah, so this was almost similar to the FER-GAIN study that we saw a little bit earlier this year, but it's taking patients' response to therapy and then kind of grouping them into a high-risk bucket where they need more or a low-risk bucket where we can get away with less and still have a good outcome. And so these patients received paclitaxel with trastuzumab, pertuzumab, so the single-agent chemo, and for 12 weeks, and then they went on to surgery. And if they had already had a pathologic complete response there, then they only continued antibodies. And if they didn't, they could get standard therapy per investigator discretion. And then they went on to get T-DM1 per Catherine. So really kind of, you know, allowing the patient to be their own prognostic indicator of those patients that are already responding so briskly to less therapy. Are we doing any benefit by giving them more?
So Dana Forber has really taken a leadership role in this whole de-escalation approach. There was a paper, I like the title of this, from San Antonio, Patient Perspectives on Chemotherapy De-escalation. Don't De-escalate, I Don't Want to Die. And Dr. Murthy had this interesting, I don't know if you want to comment on how patients, you know, sometimes just the wording of what you say affects people. What do you say to your patients?
Yeah, so I say right size for the right patient. And it maybe doesn't sound as fancy, but I think it gets the point across better. You know, de-escalation is I'm going to do less for you. It just doesn't have that right sound to it. And so it's very easy for people to misunderstand of, you know, it's your cancer is less aggressive than it could have been. I think we don't need to give as much. So really just explaining that. So we say tailoring therapy or right size for right patient or right cancer.
And I want to kind of bring in the issue of metastatic disease as well. And Dr. Atif Hussain has a 43-year-old patient where that was an issue. It's a little bit of a complicated case, but the bottom line is she had a disease recurrence after receiving neoadjuvant therapy previously. And this was actually in the middle of 2019. So there wasn't tucatinib out there. There wasn't even T-DXd. Actually, T-DXd didn't even have a name then. But in any event, so then she developed a new brain met, and he wasn't sure what to do, as you'll hear, and decided, looked up the literature and saw that T-DM1 has activity, put her on T-DM1, she responded, and she's now in her 22nd cycle. So really interesting case. Here's Dr. Hussain's comments on the case and questions for you.
When I saw her, she complained of some headache. It's like, okay, we did an MRI on March 19th. And she had a left parietal mass. Therefore, within like two weeks of stopping neratinib, she had a craniotomy. We followed it with CyberKnife. The decision we had to make was July 2019. At that time, we did not have tucatinib. And I looked at the data. You know, we could have given her trastuzumab, lapatinib. But I found actually there is some data about trastuzumab intensine versus trastuzumab lapatinib, and at least it's as effective. We started the treatment in October 2019. And also last week, December 29th, she received cycle 22. She's doing fantastic. She's a teacher and she is on video with her students. But she's doing great. Her MRI of the brain, the MRI of the brain actually done today. I just got the results. It's completely normal. After 22 cycles, I'm going to continue as long as she's doing well.
What questions would you like to see discussed in her case?
Yeah. If this patient presents now, if she presents post-neratinib, lapatinib, capecitabine, what would you give her? Would you give her trastuzumab emtansine, or would you go to tucatinib, capecitabine, and trastuzumab?
Do you have any questions about the HER-CLIMB regimen?
Many of these patients who we are starting on tucatinib, they are on cap. One of them, she is progressing on neratinib and capecitabine, and I want to give her now tucatinib, trastuzumab. I'm going to give the capecitabine because the insurance company, but honestly, my threshold to stopping capecitabine will be very, very low.
So are these the kind of cases you talk about in your Facebook group?
It is exactly what we talk about in our Facebook group. It's a great resource. There's thousands of physicians on there, and we put tough cases, and it's an easy way. In about an hour, you can get a lot of votes, so it's helpful.
I got to get you guys to present cases to us and get them on video here. So he has a whole bunch of questions, and of course, the second line question is a huge one. I mean, you hear people talking about that. You know, you have second line therapy, patient gets Cleopatra first line, and you know, T-DM1 has become kind of standard, but suppose they have brain mets.
Yeah.
A lot of, and you know, people, I know their trials looking at, you know, HER-CLIMB instead of T-DM1, but I think he was, you know, of course this is before tucatinib, but he wasn't aware. I guess there is some CNS activity of T-DM1.
Yeah, you know, traditionally we don't think that T-DM1 has a whole lot of CNS activity, but once somebody is radiated, and particularly radiation, but also just the presence of brain mets, sometimes makes the CNS and the blood-brain barrier leaky to begin with. And drugs that really traditionally shouldn't get in there incredibly well do. So we're seeing the same thing with trastuzumab deruxtecan. I mean, they haven't studied directly in a brain met population, but we're certainly seeing case reports of responses in the brain and patients that have previously had brain lesions being on trastuzumab deruxtecan and doing just as well for as long. So no, I'm not incredibly surprised this patient did well. And I think the other, you know, interesting question brought up about what about the patient that's already seen capecitabine, and that's our approved backbone. And so, you know, that's tough too. I think, you know, what was interesting about this case is at the current time now, you know, the brain lesion had been radiated and was stable. And so I think I would feel, maybe less desperate for really needing a therapy that was going to work into the brain incredibly well. I'll tell you, I participated in the tucatinib studies, but back before it was tucatinib, it was something called ONT-380. But in our phase one trial with tucatinib, we had three combinations, and capecitabine trastuzumab with tucatinib was one of them. We also had one without the capecitabine, and it was just trastuzumab tucatinib. So this certainly is not the approved regimen. It's not how it's recommended to be given, but we did see activity in that arm. So for somebody that can't tolerate capecitabine, et cetera, I think it is reasonable to drop that out and continue the antibody and the tyrosine kinase inhibitor alone.
Kathy in the chat room wants to know, is there something you could use to substitute for the capecitabine?
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, there's not a FDA-approved chemotherapy as a substitution. So I think, you know, it may be tough getting that through insurance. I certainly pursue alternative scheduling of capecitabine, whether that's 1 week on, 1 week off. You can significantly reduce the dose. The HER2CLIMB study was very liberal in what they actually allowed investigators to do. They didn't mandate our dose reductions. So for somebody that I started and had a lot of toxicity, I would kind of do two dose reductions at once. So I think even maybe a little bit of capecitabine here may be beneficial.
Interesting. So another question from the chat room. This is from Alan. Can you reflect a little on third and later line options for HER2 targeted therapy and where you see margetuximab fitting in? You can talk about what it is. And this person also wants to know, do you actually test patients for the CD16A, 15-8F, and 15-8V alleles, which he actually remembered and put in the thing. So Good memory there, Alan. But anyhow, what about margetuximab?
Yeah, so very timely questions from the panel right now. You know, margetuximab was recently approved. To be quite honest, I'm at a little bit of a loss of what to do with margetuximab. You know, the benefit for me wasn't quite as big as I would have wanted it to be. Certainly larger with those two variants of the CD16. But, you know, it wasn't approved, you know, necessitating testing of that. So, you know, I'm certainly thinking about that for later line patients. I think the real question for third line is probably a debate between trastuzumab deruxtecan and capecitabine tucatinib trastuzumab. I would use both of those before I would use a combination with margetuximab, likely.
So, you know, we're hearing about HER2 everywhere now that T-DXd is at you, where they're talking about in colon and gastric and lung and bladder, et cetera. And, you know, it also gets into what kind of HER2 issue is it? Is it a mutation? Yeah. Is it an amplification? What about this issue that, you know, this allele thing in these other cancers? Theoretically, does it make sense to look at it in other cancers?
For margetuximab?
Yeah, margetuximab and gastric, theoretically.
Yeah, you know, I don't know that we would see a big benefit for margetuximab in something like gastric. We have to remember that, you know, with gastric, we see benefit with trastuzumab. But trastuzumab deruxtecan really has been the unique drug in some of these other tumor types to provide a significant benefit. And probably why we see the benefit with trastuzumab deruxtecan kind of above and beyond some of these others is that trastuzumab deruxtecan also works where tumors are HER2 low. And or where there's tumor heterogeneity. And so I think in a lot of these other tumor types, it's not as uniform across the board where all cells are really expressing HER2. And so trastuzumab deruxtecan has the advantage of getting in there for the cells that are positive and still being able to do some of that bystander killing and killing the cells around that may not have a ton of HER2 expression.
So actually a couple of people in the chat room want to know the name of your Facebook group.
It's Women Oncology Hematology Physician Group. So it's HOWPG. If you're a woman and an oncologist, if you send me a message, we have to get like your NPI number, but I can try to get you added.
So you also has a question. Metastatic HER2 positive breast cancer with persistently low ejection fraction, less than 35%. Any thoughts?
It's tough. So number one, be in close communication with a cardiologist or your cardio-oncology colleagues if you have it. We have some cardiologists here that are very interested in that. They've even done some really great things on all of our cancer patients when they're testing echoes. They also look at something called strain, which is a little bit new above and beyond just the ejection fraction. And they can kind of predict who's going to have a problem before it happens. You know, they're very good about putting on a low-dose beta blocker or an ACE inhibitor and have really been successful in helping me boost some ejection fractions back where I felt more comfortable using therapies. T-DM1 has a lower incidence of cardiac dysfunction than trastuzumab. So that's a good drug in this space for metastatic disease, et cetera. Certainly trastuzumab deruxtecan, et cetera, also has a relatively low incidence of cardiac disease. Ultimately, sometimes it's kind of, you know, grit it and try cautiously, but I'd probably be thinking about some regimens that were not trastuzumab based to give them a break from trastuzumab.
Let's talk about San Antonio again. Here's a paper presented by a very distinguished investigator, you. More data from the HER-CLIMB study. What'd you present?
Absolutely. So this was looking at the HER2 CLIMB data and slicing it and dicing it a little bit different way. So here we're just looking for those patients, all are obviously HER2 positive, whether they were hormone receptor positive or hormone receptor negative. Progression-free survival was statistically significant across the board, regardless of hormone receptor positive or negative. And here you can see that overall survival was quite different for the hormone receptor negative subgroup. For the hormone receptor positive subgroup, still numerically favored the addition of tucatinib, but was not statistically significant. My takeaway is that the hormonally driven breast cancers are probably just a little bit more heterogeneous. This trial was not powered to slice and dice for hormone receptor positive and negative. I'm still offering this to all patients. It still improves progression-free survival statistically significantly for all patients. But, you know, the overall survival here didn't quite reach statistical significance in the subgroup analysis.
So we also saw more data this year at San Antonio from the Destiny Breast Study. And that waterfall plot last year, I remember, really blew people away. It kind of looks like it got better or something. What do you, any thoughts about the more follow-up here?
Yeah, hard to believe, right? Could it really get better? So the overall response rate is still right above 60% at 61%. So this slide really has not changed. What changed for us was progression-free survival lengthened from 16 months, essentially up to 19 months. And our overall survival was upwards of 20 months. So almost 2 years. And remember, you know, what was significant about this is that these patients were a median of 6 prior lines for metastatic disease. So really, you know, to have an overall survival here 2 years after 6 lines of therapy really just goes to speak to how powerful this drug is. You know, some people have been asking, well, why is the progression-free survival and the overall survival so close? Does that mean that everybody, when they're progressing, is immediately dying? And it's immature follow-up. And so we'll probably see some updates to this number, but there were still a lot of patients that were still on therapy here.
Quick question from the chat room. Do you need to get echo every 3 months with T-DM1?
Yeah, I do. And I've seen a lot of people be a little bit more lax about this, particularly once somebody's been on therapies for a while, you know, stretching out to every 6 months, et cetera. You know, I'm doing scans in this interval every 3 months. And if patients are going for CTs and their bone scans, I just have the echo done at the same time. And not because I'm particularly worried about it or I find a lot that are abnormal, but it's one of those things that I really do think we can benefit by getting our cardiologist just involved early to help with some medications. And so I don't want to miss it if there's something I could be doing.
So I've got to say, you know, all you Sarah Canna people, when I look in your CVs, it's like you're testing a million drugs. I love to see what you're doing. I've got to tell you, I really like the names of some of the drugs. I don't know how they work, but zenocutuzumab, that one a lot. It sounds really good. You can say it. It sounds good. And rabastinib. So yeah. I like some of the names of things. We won't even ask you how they work. You were telling me ahead of time. But you also were involved with this study that was presented. Well, you presented the study. When I saw this, I was like, oh, that's interesting. T-DXd and nivolumab.
Right. Unlikely combination, right? Unlikely to marry. So, you know, the point of this study was really to get some safety data because there were concerns, you know, if trastuzumab deruxtecan can cause interstitial lung disease. And we certainly know checkpoint inhibitors can cause pneumonitis. Are we going to see, you know, a little bit of a scary safety signal? And we did not see any increased ILD when combined with nivolumab here. And so hard to say whether we really saw any different activity. This was a phase 1 study. People were pretty heavily pretreated. But what it laid the foundation for was bringing trastuzumab deruxtecan with immunotherapy up into earlier lines. I'm participating in a trial right now that's looking at it in first line. And also they're looking at it in urothelial in combination with immunotherapy. And so now that we know that's safe, we feel comfortable putting it into larger trials.
So in urothelial cancer, I know they have enfortumab vedotin plus IO, and they're all excited about that. Is that, I guess it's sort of a similar strategy.
Yeah, you know, again, though, with trastuzumab deruxtecan, it's for those patients that have HER2 low.
Yeah.
You know, the 1+, 2+, FISH negative.
Right. So let's go to another case. This is Dr. Matt Amaral again, 73-year-old woman who presents with locally advanced disease. And here's Dr. Matt Amaral talking about how she presented and how she was managed.
She's a 73-year-old female that presented with clinical T4 breast disease. The whole breast is involved, peau de orange, and lymphadenopathy. She is right now undergoing neoadjuvant chemotherapy with dual anti-HER2 blocker therapy, as well as a taxane and a platinum.
Did you think she was aware of this and delayed seeking treatment?
She actually did delay seeking treatment. So her story originally is that she fell sort of to that left side when she was doing something. And I think it was a mechanical fall and really had some soreness of the breast, but never really had anything past that. And so then she ended up kind of neglecting any changes that happened in that breast. And they brought her here to where I practice, to the state. And I actually see her brother. So they actually said, hey, Dr. Matt, can you see her? And that's how the workup started.
Any questions about the use of post-neoadjuvant TDM1?
Yeah, I actually have a patient who ended up doing exactly as the Catherine trial prescribed with the 14 cycles of adjuvant TDM1. She actually tolerated really well. So I think the investigators could potentially touch on what would be a good way to make sure we're making it available to the appropriate patients.
So do you ever hear of traumatic? I was telling Dr. Matt Amaral, traumatic oncotaxis. Erica, you know everything. Have you ever heard of it?
No, I have not.
Well, there you go. I finally found something you don't know. Anyhow, as I was thinking about, I remember this paper when I was a fellow at the University of Miami that they had some woman who had got hit in the buttocks with a tennis ball and developed a met there. And they wrote up a few cases hypothesizing that there was some connection between trauma and oncotaxis, et cetera.
We do see women that write their breast cancers off for, hit it with the cabinet. I fell carrying groceries. I wore a bra with an underwire to a flight of Germany and came back and I ignored it. You know, it's the mind is a powerful thing when you don't want anything to be wrong to come up with reasons that there isn't.
And I think that kind of maybe is what happened here. I mean, you know, that she kept attributing, but then it got to a point where, you know, her partner was noticing it, the family was noticing it. She still didn't want to come in. So it is interesting. I don't know how often you see these cases where, you know, patients are, you know, they're going to get medical care. They take care of families. They have a job, responsible, but they have this sort of one isolated area of denial. I don't know how often you see that.
Very frequently. We had financial concerns and I was worried about what this would mean. It's a lady in her 70s that's taking care of her husband that has dementia and he needs her. And so she doesn't have time for herself. We see it, unfortunately, really frequently, actually.
So question in the chat room for Praveen. Have you seen grade 3-4 neuropathy with post, we were talking about post neoadjuvant TDM1. With post-neoadjuvant TDM1, what do you say? This is kind of tying into what Laurie was bringing up, was like sort of the ins and outs of TDM1 in really the adjuvant setting.
Yeah, TDM1 can cause some neuropathy. Traditionally these patients have just seen taxane as well. And so sometimes I think it's really the taxane too, but it certainly can get some worse on TDM1. You know, we have a relatively large literature now with taxane with cryotherapy or putting the hands and feet in ice packs during infusion. And I've done that some with my TDM1 patients too, especially if they go in with a little bit of neuropathy. And I've been pretty successful in not having that get worse. To answer Dr. Matt Amaral's question about, you know, who should get TDM1, two big tenets. One, make sure that we capture these patients with HER2 breast cancer early to give them neoadjuvant chemotherapy before surgery so we know who's high risk, who has a pathologic complete response or not. And then two, anyone that doesn't have a pathologic complete response, whether that's in breast or in lymph nodes, was eligible for the Catherine trial. And as you know, Catherine really effectively picked out high-risk patients. The control arm, disease-free survival was only 77%, which is really not impressive, and got boosted up to 88% with TDM1. So anyone that doesn't have a pathologic complete response, that's somebody I'm talking about them with TDM1.
Another great question from the chat room. Any data on IOs and PARP inhibitors in HER2 positive disease?
Yeah, that's great. And that gets right into my phase 1 drug development hat. There is definitely some data out there with immunotherapy and HER2 disease. That certainly, you know, kind of goes along with the trastuzumab deruxtecan with nivolumab. I participated in a study a couple years ago where we actually looked at some regimens like TCHP and added immunotherapy there, safe, well-tolerated. We think that if, you know, something beyond triple negative is going to have benefit with immunotherapy, it's probably going to be HER2, probably not going to be ER positive. We don't think is immunogenic as much. There's not a ton of data out there with PARP inhibitors for HER2 positive disease, but definitely something that's interesting.
So, you know, speaking of cold packs, I was just flashing on the fact I'm hearing more and more antibody drug conjugates and even other drugs that cause ophthalmic issues.
Yeah.
And there's this antibody drug conjugate in cervical cancer. I know you do gynecologic cancers as well, to sotumab vedotin, where they see these corneal cysts or something. And they actually put cold packs on their eyes during the treatment. They claim that it actually helps. So it goes along with your neuropathy thing, I guess. A couple more questions from the chat room. Elaine says that acupuncture has helped many of her patients suffering from neuropathy, but it's not covered by insurance. Any comments on that? Acupuncture?
Yeah, you know, I agree. It's unfortunate. Some of these supportive care, you know, just not covered well by insurance. You know, even, you know, care for depression, et cetera, sometimes not covered as well. Acupuncture is not covered as well. A lot of people get a lot of benefit, you know, from exercise and exercise programs, but those are hard to obtain for free, certainly. But, you know, people can use a lot of coaching there. I've had some patients that have done acupuncture and have had some benefit. So I definitely think it's something worthwhile trying if patients have means and can make that work.
So in a second, I want to conclude with one more case, but another comment from Dr. Holmes. You want to hear this one? Very interesting about traumatic oncotaxis. She says, Judah Folkman, I remember this now, interest in angiogenesis, followed his observation of recurrence of a sarcoma 20 years after curative surgery for the sarcoma in a man who had a traumatic injury to the same extremity. So the idea was that trauma was inducing neovascularity permissive for dormant Mets. Thanks a lot, Dr. Holmes. I'm curious what she thinks about this next amazing case. So this is actually Dr. Hussein was in his clinic one day, and he looks over one of the exam rooms. He sees there's a doc there, a woman in a white coat. Anyhow, here's what happened.
I was seeing patients in my office, Neil, and there is one room like with a doctor with a coat. And I tell my physician assistant, George, who's that? He said, this is the doctor. She just walked in and she wanted to talk to you, put her in office. So fine, yeah, of course. He said, I just was diagnosed with breast cancer and I already spoke to 3 doctors. I'm pregnant and all of them told me I need to have abortion. And I heard about you, I need to see you now. I said, yeah, of course, of course. He said, can you wait until my husband comes? I said, yeah, of course. At that time, she was 19 weeks pregnant, but she had this large right breast mass and the axilla was positive. We couldn't image her because she's pregnant. I said, you know what, look, you are HER2 positive. Anti-HER2 is completely contraindicated in pregnancy. Therefore, we cannot do that. But if we give you AC chemotherapy, we have to give you 6 cycles. I remember her second high-risk obstetrician called me, Neil, and asked me really an unusual question. She said, Dr. Hussein, I just saw your patient. I really gonna ask you a very personal question. I said, yeah, sure. She said, is it your religion that doesn't allow abortion and that's why it has biased you to not recommend it because everybody else is? I said, no, wait. It's an option. I gave her that option. And no, it has nothing to do with how I look at abortion. I said, okay, I just wanted to ask that. I mean, I thought it's interesting.
Wow.
So we got her through the AC chemotherapy. The second day after she delivered a healthy baby, we PET scanned her, and thank God, she has only disease in the breast, the axilla. The question now, what about neratinib? It's usually estrogen positive. They benefited more. But I mean, with 7 positive node, anybody wouldn't recommend neratinib? I already spoke to her about it and said, yes, whatever it takes. I now have 2 kids, and I want to be around there for them.
Wow, what a story. Unbelievable. Wow. Have you seen the baby?
Oh, yeah. Back within 2 to 3 days, send me pictures. I was home. They are so thankful. They are like, you know, the nicest people. I was so glad to be part of her care. It became emotional taking care of her until now. I mean, she's like part of us.
I bet. Any questions about the management of her during her pregnancy?
Yeah, in a pregnant woman like this who has rapidly growing breast cancer and who is very early in her pregnancy, she wants to keep the baby. What is the safest, I wouldn't say standard of care, probably the safest regimen you can give?
I should mention that she got therapy for the neoadjuvant therapy. She had surgery. She had post-op TDM1, and that's where he's bringing in this issue of neratinib. So we just have a couple minutes left. Maybe you can chat a little bit about your thoughts about managing women who are pregnant who have breast cancer, and also this issue of neratinib. We've been talking about it on and off. How about this situation?
Yeah, no surprise, Dr. Hussain did exactly the right thing. And this is the exception to the anthracycline role in HER2-positive disease. So we know that taxanes are contraindicated in pregnancy. Trastuzumab is contraindicated in pregnancy. So AC is traditionally what we give. Exactly right. He nailed it on the head. You know, I think what's interesting about this case is that she was already 19 weeks along. You know, a lot of times these cases are a little bit tougher when people are 7, 8 weeks and you're like, oh my gosh, we have a long way to go here. A lot of the times our high risk OBs will even kind of, you know, take the baby a little bit early, 28 weeks, et cetera, once mature to kind of allow us to get another therapy. But I think this case was handled beautifully. I mean, they wanted to keep this baby and they worked around what they could do. Didn't focus on what they couldn't do. I also would think in this circumstance, you know, certainly she still had a lot of positive nodes. She did not get ideal, you know, therapy up front before surgery. She didn't have anything against HER2, got AC, and then got the TDM1. I probably would consider neratinib in this lady. She's certainly young. She's certainly motivated. She was very high risk, and she's hormonally driven.
So maybe one more question, because I remember seeing in your CV that you wrote a review article on this topic. So you wants to know, any update on the management of HER2-low disease?
Yeah. So, you know, we had a large study looking at trastuzumab in HER2-low disease that did not provide benefit in a randomized trial. Trastuzumab deruxtecan is our drug right now that does give benefit to those that are HER2-low. The real challenge here is going to be around testing. You know, I think we all used to use IHC. A lot of our pathologists have switched over to FISH, and at some institutions, we don't even get IHC anymore. It's only a FISH. And so to kind of retrain ourselves that an IHC of 1+ or 2+ may be actionable is not really how we think. You know, even in our clinical notes, a lot of times it just says HER2 negative, right? It doesn't say HER2 1+. And so, you know, the response rates there look pretty good, upwards of 30 and 40%. And if we think about statistically how many patients with breast cancer that may be triple negative or hormone receptor positive have some HER2 expression, this is potentially a really large group of patients. So I'm intrigued to see this data as it matures further.